This is Real Talk, the Customer Insights Show with Jen Vogel, a top-rated live stream and podcast in the market research and insights industry. We stream live on LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, and you can listen on all major podcast channels. Join Jen and her guests for a weekly discussion around topics that will help you understand your customers better. Real Talk is presented to you by Vox Pop Me, the leader in video research and ranked number one in qualitative research by Grit 2 years running. Here's today's conversation.
Hello, insights professionals, marketers, and everyone who wants to understand their customers better. I'm your host, Jen Vogel. Many of us are trying to solve complex business problems, but how do we get to the answers and solutions quicker? How do we ensure that we're making the right decisions? To discuss the topic, I'm joined today by Wall Street Journal bestselling author and Vice President of Customer and Market Insights at Salesforce, Karen Mangia. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Really great to have you. And we didn't mention in the intro a like star singer as well. So thanks for a little preview of your talents before the show backstage. I know you promised not to sing on the show, but maybe we can change that by the end. We shall see.
You never know. There could be a brief Broadway stars segment, you know, inserted into our conversation. Was there ever a Broadway show about market strategy or customer listening? I guess I don't know the answer to my own question.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to like marinate on that throughout the show. If we come up with it, we'll do a little number, a duet by the end. Well, to get us started with today's show, can you tell us a little bit about your career in insights?
What's interesting about my career in insights is that it goes back to my university days. And in university, I had an assistantship in my undergraduate working with a professor. And he did research for the Radio and Television News Directors Association. He would do a survey, and my job was to follow up with survey non-respondents. Imagine that. Very little has changed in the world of surveys, hasn't it? Mm-hmm. And I would offer to either conduct the survey over the phone or to send a follow-up survey. And once we received our statistical, you know, sample that we were seeking, I would stand with him in his office in front of a whiteboard. I can still picture it. And we would be charting out themes and doing lots of manual analysis that there are now tools to do. And he would publish 6 articles a year for their magazine, their national magazine, based on the findings. And each year I would co-write 1 article with him about the state of internships, which was relevant to where I was in my university journey. As a result of that, my aspiration was to work for Nielsen. You know, at the time they did a lot with television ratings and so forth. And unfortunately, I was apparently a terrible researcher at that time because I failed to research the fact that Nielsen was headquartered in Iowa. And as a 21-year-old, Iowa did not sound like an exciting place to live. So I took a detour into the world of sales and sales leadership. And it took until my second company, Cisco, and my second or third job there to have the opportunity to lead customer experience and voice of the customer for the company globally. And what was interesting is that spending time with customers and doing sales was a valuable input into that role. And it took me probably 2 years into that role to realize I was living my dream deferred. I mean, in a way, I became the Nielsen of Cisco in a sense, and I never had to move to Iowa. So I think most insightful of all is you can live your market research dream and not have to live in Iowa to do it.
I love that path. It's such an interesting, you know, how you started in market research really in university and then moved away and still landed back. It speaks to me to the need for insights and customer understanding regardless of your role in any business. So as a salesperson, as a customer experience person, like the key is to really understand your customer.
And at its core, really every great leader is a qualitative researcher at the core when you think about it. I mean, leadership is listening. And whether your role is to listen to your colleagues for inputs on a project, whether that's to listen to your customers, whether you're a senior leader listening to employees in an employee pulse survey, at the core of leadership is curiosity, asking great questions, getting deeply curious about the answers, and then looking for trends in what you hear upon which you're willing to take action. So when I think about it, qualitative research skills are relevant regardless of your role.
That's so, so important. And I think especially now more than ever, as more companies are putting kind of empathy at the core of what they're trying to, you know, kind of filter throughout their organizations, like that, that piece, that qualitative research skill is really a key part of that. And so you work on complex business problems. Can you give me some examples of what are common complex problems and how do you know it's a complex problem?
Right now, you need only open any kind of publication to discover that the future of work is one of the most challenging scenarios we are all trying to address, because it's the intersection of our deeply held values and beliefs, along with our desire to grow and to be profitable. And really at the core of the future of work discussion, and in some organizations, the future of work debate, is about the intersection between customer experience and employee experience. Now, for many of you who are listening and watching, who are practitioners or passionate about customer experience, you're familiar with the concept of work for a long time. As practitioners and leaders in this space, and even advocates, we've been exploring the link between customer experience and employee experience. I mean, we tend to know that happier, more satisfied, more loyal employees provide better experiences to our customers. What's making this future of work conversation so complex and so in need of deep listening is because now we really have gotten down to this topic that's at the foundation, the intersection, I guess, if you want to think about a Venn diagram between customer experience and employee experience. I mean, the intersection, the center of that Venn diagram is the human experience. And wow, aren't humans complicated and fascinating? I mean, we want different things at different times. As employees, we want flexibility, autonomy, and choice. Our customers want that too. And what I'm finding is, because we're talking about the human experience and humans are complex and change, we're sitting in a place where all of our customer experience skills are relevant. Think about what happens with designing journeys, experience journeys. Right now, organizations are saying, how do we design a future of work journey that works for our organization as well as for those we serve, whether that's customers or employees, stakeholders, the planet? And so at the core of this, I see so many customer experience skills being deployed against solving this complex question of what is the future of work going to be, and how do we rework work in a way that solves for this desirable human experience?
That is, I mean, you're spot on. Like, that is the probably one of the most complex business challenges that everyone, no matter what business you're in, you're facing this right now. There's no company out there that's excluded. And you do see like a lot of, you know, the customer is first, right? And so the employee experience can be devalued in favor of serving the customer, but finding that intersection, like you were describing, and finding where everybody wins is kind of the gold standard, right? Like, how do we get to that place of understanding what everybody needs and being able to get to that? Because there's a lot of, everybody's doing it a bit differently, right? And so there's a lot of choice out there. There's a lot of opportunity to move and shake, and people are doing that. So getting to that human experience for everyone involved is definitely a key part of what we're trying to solve right now.
You said a really critical word, choice. Choice is what moves us from limited to limitless, and choice is what gets us unstuck. And at the core of that is curiosity creates choices. What we're really trying to do right now at its core is get curious enough to create choices that help us thoughtfully consider how to close the gap between what employers are willing to offer and what employees expect, between what employees and employers are willing to offer and what customers expect. And curiosity and choices are at the core of that.
Absolutely. So, I mean, either using this as that this complex problem as an example, or maybe another, can you walk through like some of the process that you go through of solving these complex problems that works for you?
Let's start with what is the problem we are trying to solve? It's rare that we have the same definition of the problem. And one of my favorite activities, you can borrow this as soon as the show is over, is to gather a group of people inside of your organization, schedule a meeting block, an hour, hour and a half. And at the beginning of the meeting, let them know you're willing to cancel the meeting. And who doesn't love that feeling? A meeting cancels and you get time back. It's like when I used to babysit and later I would find $10 in my pocket I forgot about. I mean, this is the adult version of, you know, how you feel when a meeting cancels and you get time back. And simply do this. Ask every person to just take a pen. You remember these old school pens and paper, and write down and hold up to the screen if you happen to be virtual, or put on a post-it note and post on a whiteboard if you're in person. Ask this one question. What is the customer experience we are trying to solve? Or what is the employee experience problem we're trying to solve? Let your audience know that when you can see that we all have the same framing on the problem, which you won't, by the way, spoiler alert. The next logical question would be then, what is our customer experience strategy, or what is our employee experience strategy? See, what we find is we focus on these outputs. We focus on what's down the line. You know, we focus on how this pen looks at the end without ever thinking about, you know, are we trying to solve the problem of needing a writing instrument? Well, we might not be. What you will find is scope creep, meetings, competing priorities, struggles to allocate resources often come down to we don't have the same definition of the problem. And beyond that, we have different definitions of who we are serving, why we are serving, and the greatest good we expect to come from that purpose. There is no survey that will solve that. There is no focus group that will solve that. There is no journey map that will solve for that. The root cause is, do we see the problem the same way? Then do we define who we're serving the same way? I mean, think about it. Who is your customer now is a big impact question. And if you and I have different definitions of who our customer is now or who our employee is now, all of the listening in the world isn't going to close that gap. So start there.
Alignment then. Alignment on the objectives, where you're trying to get to. You know, it is true that I was just in a conversation earlier today, and I'll totally steal this from someone else who is on the call, who's talking about, you know, how if the work, no matter how good the work is that you're doing, if it doesn't connect to the objective and help you achieve that objective. And like what you're saying, are we working toward the same objective? Is everybody on the same page here? Do we all agree what success looks like? And at the end of all this, or, you know, who this is geared towards, you know, if the work that we're doing, no matter how good it is, if it doesn't connect to that objective, then it's kind of going to fall to the side. Or, you know, if you don't have that guidance of like what the strategy is to solve that problem, there's probably 500 ways to solve a single problem. So being aligned on the strategy, what direction you're going in and what problem you're trying to solve is really key.
Do you remember solving story problems in school? Do you remember these from math?
Absolutely.
And what did they teach you? Essentially, how you frame the problem informs how you solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're talking about. I mean, we're all living inside of a giant story problem, and how we frame the problem sets up how we solve the problem. And if we don't frame the problem the same way or frame the problem correctly, we're going to end up solving the wrong problem or not getting to an aligned solution.
Yeah, totally. Why do you think people have such a hard time with that alignment? I mean, is there just like an assumption that we're all on the same page, or is it just skipping that critical step?
If I asked you right now, inside of your organization, for anyone listening, who is your customer now and how well do you know your customers? I mean, how many people inside of your organization are literally going to say to you, I have no idea. I'm not current on that. Our customers changed during the pandemic. I really don't know our core personas now. I'm not really sure how we're segmenting. No, we walk around with this assumption that we know who our customers are, what they need and want, and that our intention is serving them is pure. And in reality, the definition of who your customer is now shifts for organizations all the time. The pandemic made that a more pronounced problem, because for every organization I know, who your customer is now shifted during this last 2 years for a series of reasons. You either have a different valuation on those customers, right? Maybe you served a lot of hospitality before and you serve a lot of healthcare now. You might have introduced new products, features, services, and or even acquired a new company or merged with someone. It means the definition of your customer has shifted. We don't always all stay current on that. And inside of every organization, when we say we care about customers, we know customers, nobody wants to step up to the line and say, yeah, I really don't know what these people want. We just assume we know, and we don't challenge each other on it, even though we do see who our customers are typically very differently.
That's such a great point. Nobody thinks that they don't know who the customer is. So it's not even that we're assuming that others are on the same page. It's like, yeah, I have a very good understanding of my understanding of the customer, right?
I always say, imagine you live next door to, or you're at a cookout with someone who's one of your customers and you have a chat for 15 minutes. What happens? You go back to work the next day and you say, you know, I've spent a lot of time with our customers and I know what they want. Now, the reality is you have a sample size of one at a backyard barbecue, and yet you hold this core belief, I know our customers. And what's true for that customer at the backyard barbecue must be true for every customer we serve everywhere. And we bring that lens into our thinking process. And the reality is it's very narrow. And we know one size does not fit all, or even many in most cases.
That's such a critical point. And I mean, that brings me to the next question that I wanted to get into, which is, how does customer feedback, what's the role of getting customer feedback to solve these problems? You know, not the 15-minute conversation at a barbecue with one person, but, you know, what are some of the ways you recommend companies get feedback from customers?
The best customer feedback begins with a beginner's mind. I think back to my very first sales call. I was an accidental salesperson at AT&T because there was an early retirement program. And I was quickly thrust from project management into sales until they could hire a backfill for someone who retired. I had 100 customers called the star module. I heard, you're going to be a star. In reality, I think star probably stood for small, troubled, and risky. These were 100 of the worst, lowest performing customers in our region. Out of 100, one agreed to meet with me. Okay, so imagine how prepared I was for that one sales call, right? When I went in, I literally took printed proposals on paper, handed them out, and I proceeded to read the proposal to the customer, and I won the deal. Now, why? I didn't have a great suit. I didn't have a great pitch. I didn't even really have a pitch. You know what I had? preparedness of understanding what they cared about. Because the only section of that downloaded template I customized was what they were trying to accomplish and how our solution would do that. It took me losing many deals and leading large sales teams to understand the gift of a beginner's mind, which is the ability to hear something as if you were hearing it for the very first time. See, on that first sales call, I was hearing everything for the first time. When we are more senior in our roles, the more time we spend with customers, the more we believe we know. Knowing is the enemy of discovering. A beginner's mind says, in each conversation, in each survey response, I will forget everything I know based on my experience. So what I hear right here, right now is fresh and first, and therefore can shape me. See, when we believe we know what our customers want because we've met with so many of them, or we've surveyed so many thousands of them, or we analyze this feedback for a living, we think we know, and knowing is the enemy of discovering.
That is so interesting. You know, that I've been reading a book recently about the empathy crisis, and that is one of the areas of is about sort of dismantling what you think you know, in order to do proper discovery. But, you know, I guess, how does that jive with, you know, having a broader understanding of your customers? Like, you know, there is an element of needing to understand customer needs at a broad level in order to solve those problems. And then, like, having that knowledge, but also at the same time, forgetting about it for a moment, to learn about the person that's right in front of you. Like, how do you kind of take what you know to guide you without letting it bias what you're discovering?
How much of your voice of customer program is based on asking customers what you want to know and listening for what you hope to hear? Versus listening to what the customer wants you to know and what they critically need you to hear. And here's the difference. If I were to send you a survey, if I were to invite you to a focus group or to an advisory board, I likely would have spent time with my colleagues thinking about what do we want to know and what's the hypothesis of what we're going to hear. Our customers tell us every single day in big and small ways what they want us to know, and it gets lost in the noise. A great example of an experience where a customer is telling us what they need us to know, hear, internalize, and take action on is contacting customer support. Mm-hmm. If you're not mining those calls and transcripts for what your customers are telling you that you don't ask about, you're missing what's on your customer's agenda. That's just one example of a place where a customer is contacting you, and within that conversation, they're telling you what's on their agenda. They're letting you know the gap between the promised experience and the lived experience, the gap between experience and expectation. How often do we jump to the survey, the customer advisory board, the focus group, when customers are constantly sending us signals of what they want us to know versus what we want to know?
Yeah, that's so true. And to your point earlier, you know, when you started in university, you were reaching out to survey non-responders. These are them. They're proactively reaching out to help you solve a problem. They're telling you exactly the problem that they're having in that moment. And I love what you said about like the gaps between the expected, I'm botching what exactly the word to use, but the gap between the expected experience and the lived experience is right there in front of you. But I mean, do you think that we don't have great ways to mine that now, or are we just not interpreting it well enough? Like, what are some of the challenges with getting to that?
Ego.
Interesting. Tell me more about that.
We want to know that we know what's best for our customers, and we want them to want it too. And if you doubt me, take an example in your organization. I'll pick fertile ground here, ease of doing business. How many people listening have some kind of ease of doing business question and measurement? Someone listening right now is going to tell me that ease of doing business is a key driver of your net promoter score. And so you've done statistical regression analysis to uncover the top 10 drivers of ease of doing business, and you've correlated in that list, right? The needle movers, right? Well, how many of those are difficult to do? Probably a lot of them. Is easy a destination that's realistic in your business? When you say to a customer, ease of doing business is our top goal, we're going to focus on these 10 drivers. Is easy realistic? Probably not. I mean, I work in high tech. It's complex. Easier is possible. Easy? Probably not. So here's the reality. We start to invest then. People, time, money, resources. I mean, we have the 5-year, five-phase, $5 million project, and your customer may have moved on. First of all, might not be the right problem. Second, may not be a realistic outcome. Third, you may never get there. But then when you commit time, money, and resources, only to discover that net promoter score isn't changing, only to discover that ease of doing business score isn't changing, what happens? Do people pause and go, I think we should cancel this initiative. Maybe we should reconsider. Maybe we're solving the wrong problem. Maybe the problem isn't solvable as framed. Do we cancel or do we keep going? We probably keep going. If you looked at the most senior executive in your organization and said, we are investing in programs that do not solve our customers' problems. Here's all the data, here's all the research, and here's what we need to cancel. What do you think would happen in your organization? Would that be met with, well, we're customer first, and if the customer's needs have shifted, so should our portfolio? Or would it be met with, maybe you should update your LinkedIn profile and find another job?
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a good point. And it does link back with the alignment from the get-go of what problem you're trying to solve and for who. And, you know, we talk a lot about defining what success looks like. And we do this a lot at Vox Popme, like defining what failure looks like too. We're very experimental. We're trying, you know, kind of new things. We like to fail fast is what we say. We're not the only ones that take that approach. But if you understand going into it, what failure looks like, what's that trigger point where you say, this isn't working. It's not achieving our objectives. We should can it. You know, if we're all in agreement on that, before we embark on whatever time, resource, focus you put on solving that problem, then it is easier to come back around and say, hey, remember we agreed upon this 3 months ago, 6 months ago, 5 days ago, it's not working. Let's shift. Whereas if you just kind of all are full steam ahead without that alignment in the beginning, it is harder for any executive to walk into a room and say, we need to can this, we need to, you know, based on customer feedback and data, we need to shift. It's a lot harder to do that if you haven't agreed at the start what success and failure looks like.
We tend toward the grand gesture when we need the 5-minute fix. And here's what I mean by this. In organizations, we talk about think big, act small, and yet we often don't operate that way. As opposed to 5 years, 500 people, $50 million. What could you do with $5, 5 people, 5 minutes? And here's the magic of 5 minutes. Whatever problem you're trying to solve, when you create alignment around it, think about as many 5-minute experiments you could take to move yourself and your organization and your customers toward your desired outcome. Here's the power of 5 minutes. We don't overinvest. We discover very quickly what works, what doesn't work, and what's the smallest thing we could give ourselves permission to adjust. The beauty of 5 minutes as well is 5-minute fixes create momentum. Even if you made a 1% daily improvement on your initiative, 72 days from now, you would have more than doubled your impact. It keeps you out of the grand gesture where you've overinvested and now feel you have to stay the course on something that doesn't serve you or your customers, and instead says, how could we move as quickly as possible, a little bit at a time, and embrace this mindset of discovery, win quick, fail quick, keep moving.
I love that momentum. It's so key. And that being able to iterate, I think we're seeing that a lot too with, you know, a lot of companies on the CPG side of things that are, you know, development and innovation cycles were 18 months, 2 years, 3 years to bring new products to shelf. And now there's these, you know, agile innovation labs that are trying to bring products in 6 months or 4 months. And, you know, what's minimally viable? How can you test and iterate in market? And actually, I mean, it's not quite 5 minutes, you know, 6 months, but it's that general kind of like agile iterative approach to solving these problems. And every step of the way, bringing the customer in and checking, are we solving that problem? Are we meeting that need that we identified and making those changes along the way, not trying to get to something perfect. We don't have to get to 100%. We can get to 60%, get it out there, test it, fix it, test it again, relaunch it, you know, and really take that more iterative approach, I think we're seeing it over all types of businesses, whether it's B2B, SaaS companies and product companies, which I think that's where maybe it kicked off a bit, but it's really now emerging in a lot of these CPG and direct-to-consumer product companies as well that are just able to iterate faster and maintain that momentum and really innovate in a smarter way, which is really exciting to see.
5-minute fixes introduce constraints. And when you create constraints, it puts you in the mindset of start where you are and work with what you have. And I'll give you an example from the medical world. There was a breakthrough scientist and physician who ultimately discovered and introduced something called constraint-induced movement therapy. And here's how it works. He took people who had strokes, and 80% of them went through the traditional treatment program. He took 20% and introduced a constraint. So the thought process behind traditional therapy, if you've had a stroke and some resulting paralysis or challenges with motor skills, is to strengthen, right, the part of your body that isn't working, right? But you know, you keep working on, you know, building this muscle. And what he did was with his group of the 20% of stroke patients, the constraint was he completely bound up your healthy arm and hand. So imagine if it was my right side that was working incredibly well, I would have the constraint of not being able to use it. And then he took stroke patients through a series of exercises to strengthen the part of their body that had become weak and weakened due to the stroke. So they would start working on, you know, playing with a deck of cards or lifting their hand. Over time, his patients experienced a significantly higher rate of recovery. What did he do? He constrained the part that was entirely healthy, the muscle that was well-developed. And think about this inside of organizations, right? We have some well-developed muscles and we tend to default to what we do well, when sometimes what we need to do is strengthen the underutilized part of the organization. And so that 5-minute fix introduces a constraint that says, I know you know how to build a long-term plan with a lot of parts that's complex. If I constrain your ability to use that, it can't take a year. It can't take $1 million. It forces you to build an underutilized muscle through the constraint that says, what could you do with less? How could you start with where you are and work with what you have?
Yeah, and that's such a special skill to be able to like get scrappy and be limited by, you know, because like you said, you give anybody $1 million budget and all the time in the world, you can figure something out. But what can you do with $5, 5 minutes, 5 people? I love that. I'm going to take that with me for sure. And I guess in that process, that sort of like innovative, very like momentum driven process, how does, you know, customer feedback come into that and help to drive those like actionable insights that inform maybe that next 5 minutes or the 5 minutes after that?
The genius question. That's what I called it in my book, Listen Up. And the genius question was inspired by one of my favorite entrepreneurs. Now, in this case, she happens to be a pastry chef. And we've all experienced these beautiful celebration cakes, right? The birthday cake, the wedding cake, this multi-tiered thing. Well, those are very time-consuming to create. And if you've never done this before, I'm fortunate that I have. I'm actually a professionally trained chef. You have a wheel, okay? And you place a layer of this cake on a wheel and you put frosting on the side with a flat spatula while this wheel is spinning to basically create the flat frosting that you're going to attach all those beautiful decorations to. And one day she must have been frosting her bazillionth cake. And she looked at this and thought to herself, what would this look like if it were easier? And so what she decided to do was not frost the sides of the cake. She built a $25 million business by taking the frosting off the side of layer cakes. Her name is Christina Tosi. She's a chef that created this business called Milk. And you have seen her designs replicated many, many times. When I think about what that has to do with our conversation here today, think about a couple of things. First, what would this look like if it were easier? The genius question, when posed to your customers, invites a journey of iteration that says, how could we make this easier? How could we make progress 5 minutes at a time? What's the frosting we could take away from the sides of our cake, proverbially speaking, right? When Christina Tosi challenged the notion of the birthday cake and the wedding cake, she challenged something that shows up in business, which is nostalgia. We call it the way we've always done things. Well, what would happen if we ask this, how could we make it easier together question to our customers? Do you know what you would surface? Lots of small iterative steps we could take together that when done consistently over time do make it easier. They also build trust and momentum, which means listening to customers doesn't become a big momentous event that happens once or twice a year that we go away and analyze and produce reports, at which point customers forgot what they said and they've moved on to a different problem and now we have to start again. It says, when we take the frosting off the sides of our proverbial cake, we expose the layers inside of our organization, and that's where the goodness happens. Mm-hmm. A little at a time, what could we take away? What could we iterate? How could we go on this journey of discovery together a little at a time?
Okay. We are now going in a direction that I'm very excited about. I'm a huge fan of hers, and I think that your example is, I mean, we often think about what can we add, right? What can we add to our offering or to make things easier or to, we very rarely think about what can we take away? What functionality is unnecessary, is overcomplicating? And I love that genius question. It really is genius of how can we, what would this look like if it were easier? I wrote it down so I wouldn't mess it up. I think that's spectacular. And, you know, that is such a, it's just a different twist on what we're looking at. Like, not what can I add to, what can I create that's new, that's nobody's ever seen before. It's what can I remove from the process, from remove that friction or that extra step or whatever it might be. And I have made some of her cakes and recipes and her crack pie. Actually, that's one of my most requested dessert dishes when I go somewhere and bring something. But I wouldn't say that her recipes are anything easy, but they are spectacular at the end.
Imagine how much more challenging they would be if you still had to frost the sides of the cake. I mean, there'd be more steps. And your point is a great one. Success and progress are more often about what we take away than about what we add. I mean, think about how many times inside of your team or organization you've done one of these stop, start, continue activities as a means of prioritization. How many things do you actually stop? Almost never. You almost never, I will tell you, stop something, you start things. Mm-hmm. And then what happens? It gets more complex, it gets more complicated, it takes more time, it takes more resources, you lose momentum, you lose morale. What would this look like if it were easier?
Mm-hmm. I think the other genius thing for me about that question is that it puts it into the perspective of the customer. Like, what would it look like if it were easier for you? Not, you know, tell us more about us and what you love about our product, or, you know, talk to me about us. It's really more about you, right? What would it look like if it were easier for you, which maybe isn't in the question, but it's implied for me. And I think that's a really important thing. I think we do tend to want to ask about us. We want to ask about our products and our brand and our offering, as opposed to just asking about people, you know, what's going on in your world and what are you trying to solve for? And what, not only what would it look like if it were easier, but how much more valuable would it be to you if it were easier, if it saved you X amount of time or whatever direction you're kind of going in, but sort of reframing it as like from the perspective of the customer, as opposed to tell me about us.
Well said.
Well, this has been a really great conversation. I can't thank you enough for coming on today and talking to all of us about these complex business problems and getting customer feedback to solve them. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for a great conversation. And I look forward to hearing from your listeners about some of the new questions they're asking that are really opening up and changing the conversation and pointing them and hopefully all of us in the direction of discovery.
Yeah. Well, anybody listening in, please share with us the innovative questions that you're asking and how that's changed your customer feedback program. We'd love to hear that from you. Thanks for listening in today. Next week, we are talking to Kyle Papanicolaou, actually later this week. So we will see you all then.